Hello, everybody, and welcome to this RCGP Osteoarthritis Podcast. I'm Kevin Barrett, a GP in Hertfordshire, and I'm here talking to Danny Murphy, who's a GP in Honiton and a staff gate rheumatologist at the Royal Devon and Exeter Hospital. Danny, do you want to introduce yourself and tell us a bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. So as you said, my name is Danny Murphy. So I work half my time as a GP principal in rural general practice in Honiton and Devon. Spend half my time working as an associate specialist rheumatologist in Exeter at the Royal Devon Exeter Hospital. And I also work as a muscular skeletal champion at Versus Arthritis.
Super. So lots of experience with dealing with patients with osteoarthritis. So osteoarthritis, it's something that we see almost every single day as GPs, and we think we know what it is. And certainly I have been around long enough that, you know, I was taught at medical school it's just wear and tear arthritis, but that's not actually true, is it? Can you tell us a bit about osteoarthritis, what it actually is, and what the current theories and thinking is about it, please?
What we know about joints, exactly, you know, we were all taught, or lots of us were, that this is wear and tear disease. There's not an awful lot we can do to intervene with it, but I think there's now lots of evidence that shows that that's not the case, that our joints are metabolically really active tissues. This idea that they were inert, that cartilage was inert, we're now sure is not true. What certainly can happen with joints, if our lifestyles mean that the loads on them start to outweigh their ability to repair themselves, we can start to see the joint becoming progressively damaged. And that's what causes osteoarthritis. This idea that load and wear outweigh the body's ability to repair itself. But the idea that that is something that's intractable, that we can't intervene with, just isn't true. We know that really this is what we should call wear and repair arthritis. Your body's joints have the ability to repair themselves. Now, when they make those repairs, they might not look the same, they might not feel the same, but there's no reason at all that a joint can't get back to being a healthy working joint with very low or no levels of pain. So our job really as GPs is first to identify osteoarthritis, to make sure that we're happy identifying it clinically, but then to empower and educate our patients to say, well, look, what we need to do here is to try and redress that balance between the wear in a joint and the repair, allowing our body's joints to repair themselves and get back to a state of normal functioning with less pain, better function, and less impact on people's lives.
Fantastic. I think that difference between wear and tear and wear and repair is something that I need to actually get my head around and to get that that analogy sorted out when I'm talking to patients. So, but I guess that also makes a difference, doesn't it? Because that changes who might be at risk of OA. So which particular groups are actually at risk? Because I know we've got our classic ones we think of on our heads, but in reality, who's more at risk?
So I think, you know, it's sort of self-evident, really, isn't it, who's at risk of OA in lots of ways. You know, the common risk factor being age, that as we age, there is more chance that our joints will be damaged. And we know that osteoarthritis is a disease of people in later life. But there are also other things that can increase your risk of OA. So if we think about the common ones, obesity being really common, now that's probably because we put more load through our joints if we're carrying more body weight. But it's probably something metabolic that obesity does as well. So we know that people who are obese get much more arthritis in their hands and thumbs, and we certainly don't weight bear through our hands. There's lots of animal models when they've suspended mice by their tails and made them very fat and obese that mice still get lots of osteoarthritis in their back legs even when they're not using them. So probably adipocytes are metabolically active and are driving an increased wear process in our joints. So age and obesity are certainly the main factors. Interestingly, we know that gender has an impact on our joints. So women are more likely to develop OA. I'm not really sure why that is. It's probably something hormonal. And there are also environmental factors. So cigarette smoking probably increases the rate of wear on your joints and reduces your body's ability to repair. And then there are certain occupations as well. There are certain things which we do to our joints, which make it more likely that we will accelerate that wear process. So classically, manual workers, you know, electricians driving screws and getting thumb-based OA, so osteoarthritis at the base of their thumbs. people who bear a lot of weight on their joints. And the last one is trauma. So we know that people who've had traumatic episodes and damage to their joints through trauma, again, through the disruption, that normal physiological wear and repair mechanism, might be an increased risk.
So I guess, yes, that metabolic cause is definitely part of it. I can think of patients who are, you know, used to be typists, for example, who tend to get a lot of it in their thumbs. But it's not just about the physical effect, is it?
And I think genetics as well plays quite a key role. They've got a strong family history in osteoarthritis. So you see a lot of people who've got a strong family history of nodal OA, you know, OA in their hands. So a really good question, if you think somebody's got osteoarthritis in their hands, you know, did your mum and dad have hands that look like yours? And it's really common that osteoarthritis runs in family, again, lending weight to the idea that there's something metabolic, genetic, driving what, you know, your risk of OA.
So lots of questions to ask our patients. And I know in these times of COVID and remote consulting, it's quite hard to actually see every single patient face to face. So any top tips about diagnosing osteoarthritis, particularly during the remote consultations?
So I think, you know, the key thing here, and it's, I often end up like a broken record banging on about this, is, you know, to trust our clinical skills, because we're really good at this. You know, as GPs, we see a lot of osteoarthritis. We're really good at it. I think, you know, there's an awful lot of sort of weight driven behind this idea of frailty now, looking after patients who are frail. I often look at frailty and think, well, frailty is really osteoarthritis. You know, if we were to change the name to call it frailty OA, all of a sudden, it becomes a much bigger, more important clinical problem. So I think, how do we diagnose it? It's listening to our spidey sense, listening to our clinical skills. OA is very unusual under the age of about 45. So it's unusual in younger people. It's a chronic disease. It's not something that comes on suddenly. So somebody who's got gradual onset pain past the age of 45, by far and away the most likely diagnosis is OA. Doesn't mean that everybody will have OA, but it's a big clue. What are the other things that point us towards a diagnosis of OA? Well, it tends to be in load-bearing joints. We all know the classical places, the knee being the most common place in the body, your hips and your thumb bases being the most common places. But you might see somebody who's had what we call load-bearing shoulders. Classically, people in wheelchairs are using their arms an awful lot to push themselves out of chairs. Occupationally, plasterers, builders, lots of people who are working above head height. So think about OA when you've got chronic onset, gradual onset pain in an older person. It's typically asymmetrical, and it doesn't have any of those inflammatory features that we see with inflammatory arthritis, so significant early morning stiffness and marked swelling.
So I think I used to just x-ray everybody who came in who I thought might have osteoarthritis, mm-hmm. and that's probably not that useful, because I've seen papers where they've looked at people with asymptomatic joint, you know, joint disease, and found that, you know, as one gets older, then you see changes on x-rays. And I think there's always that difficulty, isn't it, between deciding what is significant on an x-ray versus not. So do we need to image everybody?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I think, you know, the classical teaching is that we shouldn't we? You know, if we think this is osteoarthritis, we should request an x-ray. I guess what you've got to think about whenever you request a test are two things, aren't there? Number one is the pre-test probability of the diagnosis that you're looking for. So if it's highly likely that the patient that you're talking to has osteoarthritis, is an x-ray going to change that diagnosis? Probably not. And the other thing is how this changes your management. You know, does a test change how you manage somebody? So if you think clinically somebody's got osteoarthritis and their x-ray comes back with a pristine joint, is it going to change what you do? It's probably not. You're still going to talk to them about wear and repair disease, encourage them with exercise and weight loss and analgesia. So NICE are very clear about this, that if somebody presents after the age of about 45 with pain which looks, sounds and feels like osteoarthritis, which is gradual in onset, doesn't have any inflammatory features, we don't need to request an x-ray, and we shouldn't be doing it in primary care for the reasons that we talked about. It doesn't help your diagnosis and it doesn't change your management. Now, that might be different if you think somebody's heading on for a joint replacement, because an x-ray might well help an orthopaedic colleague plan an operation. But in general, in primary care, there isn't really a role for x-ray in the diagnosis and management of OA.
I agree. It can become problematic because then patients want to have another x-ray repeated in 2 years, 5 years, just to see if things have progressed, and you end up in all sorts of problems with that too. So it's good to have that backup from NICE, that we don't have to do the x-ray, because some patients expect to have an x-ray done. So that's really useful. Thank you, Danny. I guess also the other thing that people get a bit worried about is are red flags. So, what differential diagnosis are we worried about? I mean, clearly in somebody who presents with a very short history of a hot, swollen, painful joint, that's quite obvious. But is there anything more subtle that we need to be worried about?
So I think, there are two real groups of red flags, aren't there? The things that need acting on today, as you mentioned, the obvious one is septic arthritis. Somebody comes in unwell with a fever, with a rapid onset of a sore, swollen joint, then that's septic arthritis until proven otherwise, and usually needs an orthopaedic review that day. There are some slightly more subtle questions, aren't there? Something people often talk to me about is missing malignancy. We know that malignancy can present with joint pain. I think what I would say is that the most common and most important predictive factor is somebody having red flag malignant pain is a history of a prior malignancy. So somebody in whom they haven't had a previous cancer, it's unusual. But it goes back to listening to that spidey sense. So cancers are progressive, they cause lots of other symptoms, weight loss, malaise, symptoms locally derived from a cancer. So it's important to think about that. We then move on to the other category, things that we shouldn't really miss when we're thinking about a diagnosis of OA. So that's inflammatory arthritis. Now, there are lots of different types of inflammatory arthritis, but autoimmune, so rheumatoid and psoriatic and spondyloarthritis, or gout. So again, this comes back to the clinical history, listening to the patient, listening to our spidey sense. OA is a chronic disease. It's gradual onset, usually asymmetrical, and the joints that we've talked about. Whereas inflammatory arthritis tends to be the exact opposite. It tends to come on fairly quickly, often small joint, but can be large joint. And it's associated with lots of those inflammatory features. So there's significant early morning stiffness of at least 30 minutes and often longer. The stiffness that gets better with exercise and worsens when you rest. And really importantly, that idea of nocturnal pain. So pain that wakes you up from sleep and then you have to get up and move around to settle down. So they're the red flags of inflammatory pain that we should always be looking for. Now, if general practice was simple and easy, it'd be really boring, wouldn't it? So it's not easy, it's not straightforward. And if you were to say as a binary question to somebody with, let's say, knee osteoarthritis, are you stiff when you get up in the morning? They would all say yes. Because the joints rested overnight, it's stiffened, those tissues are stiffened up. But the key thing is, how long does that last for? So somebody with knee OA, let's say 5-10 minutes, by the time I've got up, had a shower, walked down, have a cup of tea, it's getting better. Somebody with inflammatory arthritis, that won't be the case. It will last, and it will last for 30 minutes, an hour and a half. The same with nocturnal pain. Somebody with mechanical shoulder pain or knee pain, if you ask the binary question, do you get pain at night? Almost always they'll say yes. It's usually when they're getting in bed and when they're settling down and getting comfortable. Or it can wake them up, but it's short-lived. It lasts for a few seconds when they turn over and move, and then it settles down and they can go back to sleep. So inflammatory pain or red flag pain doesn't do that. So to summarise that, I almost think inflammatory pain and mechanical pain are diametric opposites. So mechanical pain is gradual in onset, pain gets worse with use and eases with rest, and we don't have those inflammatory symptoms. Inflammatory pain is the exact opposite. It tends to be acute or subacute, significant early morning stiffness, pain that gets better with exercise and worsens with rest, and those nocturnal witching hour, 3-4 o'clock in the morning symptoms that we need to look for.
Yeah, absolutely. I think like lots of illnesses, the those that affect you or disturb your sleep are actually much more significant than those that let you have a good night's sleep as well. So we can apply the same to a whole range of different conditions too. So yeah, cool. Thank you. So I guess reading on from this, we talked about wear and repair versus wear and tear. So once you've actually made the diagnosis, what's the advice you give in terms of the language we might use to patients and sort of the advice we would give to them once we've made that initial diagnosis?
This is what I really wanted to get across in this podcast. And this, to me, is the key of managing osteoarthritis. So if we think of a patient who comes in let's say, a 50-year-old lorry driver, a 52-year-old, with his first presentation of pain due to knee osteoarthritis, not somebody comes in often, this might be the single most important consultation he has in his life. And I know that sounds hyperbole, but if we drill into that in a little bit more detail, if we see him and we say, well, you've got knee osteoarthritis, and our language is negative. So if we use this idea of this is wear and tear disease, it's a little bit of arthritis, it's arthritis, lots of terminology we use, don't know, like bone on bone, there's lots of damage in there, this is wear and tear disease. You give the impression this isn't going to get better, that he's always going to have pain, and there's nothing he can do to change this. And that sets him on the path of chronic illness, of thinking, actually, I'm not in control of this. There's nothing I can do to manage this. I almost might as well give in. I might as well take regular medication. I'm definitely going to need a knee replacement. And patients come in and tell us these things. These are what they've been told. If we compare and contrast that, and we say, well, actually, how would we like a model consultation to run? Well, it's setting the scene that this is not wear and tear disease, but it's wear and repair disease. So, look, you know, there's some damage in your knee, absolutely. We see that all the time. But your knee can repair itself. What we've got to do is we've got to help it do that. We've got to help your body help itself. And setting the scene so that he can self-manage. Thinking about the things we know are effective in knee OA. So increasing activity levels, increasing quad strength, allowing him to see this as something that he can manage himself, to personalise the manage of his health condition. And then allying that to lots of the things around living a healthy life. So reducing his body weight, if he's a little bit overweight, reducing his cigarette smoking, if he's a smoker. So all of these things feed in to seeing OA not as a condition that's necessarily going to influence his life, not as a condition that's going to cause lifelong immobility and disability, but a condition that is very much manageable, that we can definitely intervene with, and that he's in control of.
Absolutely. It's empowering the patient and giving them the idea that this is not a progressive diagnosis that they have no control over that's going to deteriorate as time goes on. Definitely. And that's something I've learnt over my years as a GP. And I know examples of patients who've been told exactly what you said at the beginning, and they've almost given up and stopped trying, which is really tragic, I think. So you mentioned about patients taking medication as well. So are there any magic medications that we should give our patients? Is there anything we should prescribe or should avoid prescribing, rather?
So I think that's a really difficult question to answer, isn't it? So again, NICE are pretty clear on this. And I think there was a lot of criticism in the NICE OA guidance when it came out, because it seemed like they weren't allowing us to prescribe anything. You know, they were suggesting that paracetamol's not that effective. They were certainly suggesting we should avoid opiate analgesia. And that, I think, as GPs, puts us in a really hard position, doesn't it? Particularly when you've got patients who've got this established health behaviour, that osteoarthritis is something that they need help with, that there's something that we have to do as physicians to prescribe for them. I think the key thing we've already talked about, the non-pharmacological management, how can we support patients with prescribing? Well, I think it's around the use of PRN simple analgesia. So non-steroidals, if appropriate, they won't be for lots of patients. Potentially trialing topical non-steroidals. There is some evidence that it can help, particularly with small joint osteoarthritis of the hands. I think avoiding the use of opiate analgesia is important. We know that it isn't particularly effective in managing OA. It's strongly habit-forming. We're all becoming much more aware of that. And what we're trying to do here is to demedicalize this condition, to get away from the idea that this is something that medicine has to manage, to giving patients and empowering them to give them the idea that they can manage this themselves. But as we talked about, general practice isn't easy, is it? It's not straightforward. Everybody's different. And there will be patients who you think, actually, you've got intractable pain. It's not unreasonable to try regular analgesia, but I think we've got to have a very clear pathway where we review that and manage that, so that if it's not working, we can stop it. What else can we do? Well, we can think about joint injection. So that's something that we can help with in primary care. So joint injection can play an important part in the management of osteoarthritis. But again, it's an adjunct to all the other things we've talked about. So injection provides short-lived relief from pain and stiffness and inflammation. But I always sell that to patients as, this isn't going to treat your OA, this isn't going to be a magic cure. What this is going to do is it's going to help settle that pain down so that you can then go away and work really hard at the exercise and physiotherapy so that when the injection starts to wear off, your muscles will be stronger, your joints will be healthier, and you'll have less pain.
I agree. I think the joint injections, they're interesting. I really enjoy doing them as a GP because it's something that you can actually physically do that gives you a sense of benefit quite quickly to most patients. But I think the old advice about no more than two injections per joint per life probably still stands.
Yeah, I think it depends on the patient, doesn't it? I think, you know, we've all got people who we know probably need a joint replacement but aren't fit enough. You know, if you're in your 80s and 90s and have multiple comorbidities and a real functional impairment, that's saying, look, let's try and manage this with two or three joint injections a year is probably the least of several evils. But I think you're absolutely right. If somebody's coming back needing or requesting recurrent joint injection, that tells me that, we might be missing something. We might be missing an alternative diagnosis. Or B, actually, are they somebody who might need to speak to an orthopaedic surgeon and consider joint arthroplasty? Because it might be then that an orthopaedic opinion is the lowest risk management strategy.
Absolutely. I think even before COVID happened, that was something I was reducing the number of injections I was doing just purely because we're trying alternative measures first of all. I guess the other thing to think about as well, we talked about pharmaceutical or pharmacological management of OA and a little bit about some lifestyle things, but patients often ask us about nutritional supplements, things like glucosamine and chondroitin and those sorts of things, plus a load of other sort of less well publicized herbal and over-the-counter supplements too. Which one of those should we be recommending for our patients?
I think to start, I think we would say that NICE guidance is that we should avoid the use of nutraceuticals. So NICE has been very clear that there isn't an awful lot of evidence supporting the use of any nutritional supplements in OA. The only sort of very loose, very weak evidence is for the use of high dose mixed fish oil. So not cod liver oil, but mixed fish oil. And the studies that did that used really high doses, 6 to 8 capsules a day, which is expensive and makes you smell quite fishy. So what do I say practically to patients? I think patients often come to us with a fixed agenda, with fixed ideas, being honest, and it's not often we can change that. My advice to them is usually, look, these supplements are low risk. There's a low chance of them doing you harm, so try them. You know, being honest, the worst you're going to lose is 10 quid. You know, the most harm it's going to do to you is your wallet. But have a low threshold for stopping them if they don't help. I certainly don't recommend them because I think, you know, as an evidence-based physician, as an evidence-based GP, I don't think I can go out there and support somebody or advise somebody taking them. But again, I think, you know, what we've got to do is explore people's health beliefs to help them make their own choices. And I certainly would not stop somebody who's very keen on going taking supplements from doing so. I might just gently remind them the evidence isn't great, and please do it alongside all the other things we've talked about. So keeping fit and healthy, maintaining good muscular strength, losing weight, doing all of the other things we've mentioned.
Absolutely, I would agree. I think I can think of patients who have gained some perceived benefit from a whole range of different supplements without naming any particular ones. But again, that shouldn't be taken in isolation. It's the whole patient approach.
Yeah. And if the benefit they get is the placebo effect, does it matter? If they feel better, it doesn't really matter. As long as it's not doing them harm, to be honest, I don't have a huge problem.
Yeah, and as long as they can afford it as well.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I guess, I mean, there's a lot of information out there about this because, again, we see our patients going on internet searches and bringing clippings from newspapers about all sorts of different things that have been recommended for them. What actual, what websites or information or sources or patient organisations would you direct patients to get further authenticated, endorsed, peer-reviewed advice?
I think the Versus Arthritis website has got some really fantastic resources on there about osteoarthritis in general, but also specific joint-based osteoarthritis leaflets, so knee, hip, and hands, with some really clear exercise advice. And I think that's really important. I think one resource that I'm really, really keen to promote is something called Escape Pain, which is a Versus Arthritis and NHS England resource. It was group-based physiotherapy pre-COVID, worked really well in leisure centres, had really, really good feedback and really good outcomes. It's now switched to an online offering. So if patients Google Escape Pain, there are two different pathways on there. There's one for back pain and one for hip and knee pain. And this is not just physiotherapy. This is osteoarthritis education. So offering people the things we've talked about, teaching them about persistent pain and chronic pain, how we can manage that, how to manage the days when you're struggling with pain. But there's also lots of advice in there about exercise and appropriate focused physiotherapy exercise. And I think the NHS website as well is really got really good resources on for osteoarthritis and for people's increase in exercise in general. So things like Couch to 5K, I think patients really like that. They're really involving patients. They've got really good outcomes. So that's what I would tend to send patients onto. I think they are websites that are really well peer reviewed. They've got a good evidence base, and I think you can send patients and people onto them with a high degree of certainty that they're going to get very clear, very accurate, very well written evidence-based information.
Super, thank you, Danny. I think that's going to be something that I'm going to take away and start recommending more to my patients. So I think my take on message really about this is that we should empower our patients, get them to lose a bit of weight, become more active, become a little bit sweaty every day, huge range of things in that field. So and giving that empowerment to patients. So how would you summarise our conversation, Danny, please?
So, I think, how would I like to summarise this? I think osteoarthritis is almost the archetypal disease that can be self-managed, that we're going to try and demedicalise and get away from the idea that it has to be, a doctor-agendered-led process. So getting back to this idea that osteoarthritis is wear and repair disease rather than wear and tear disease, that through lifestyle change, we can enact really, really important and really clinically relevant outcomes and improvements of patients through weight loss, exercise. As you put it well, getting sweaty every day is really helpful. And getting away from this idea that patients need to come to us, that we can help empower them and educate them to manage this long-term condition without necessarily needing an awful lot of medical intervention.
That's fantastic. Some very clear messages there. Danny Murphy, thank you very much for talking to us, and we'll find more resources on the RSGP website. Thank you. Goodbye.